We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University and author of Building a Business of Politics, The Rise of Political Consulting and the Transformation of American Democracy by Adam Scheingate. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's start with you. Give an extended history of not just of political consultants, but of the development of political consultancy. Just give us an abbreviated account up until 1971, I think it is, when Buckley v. Vallejo changed the dynamic.
So the prehistory of political consulting is a history of individuals coming out of public relations, advertising, what was called publicity in the early part of the 20th century, who wanted to apply the techniques of marketing, essentially public relations, that they had developed first in the business world for products, for companies, and apply that to the political world on behalf of candidates and political parties. And so the prehistory is really the development of those techniques or the migration of those techniques from business to politics. And then the question that I'm trying to address in the book is, well, how did this become a business of politics? Which is to say, how did the people who developed these techniques or applied these techniques to the political realm figure out how to make a living doing it? And that's the part that really doesn't take off until the 1970s and 1980s, where you really have a campaign consulting industry where people are making a living and making a good living by providing these services to candidates.
Well, in that prehistory, was there any particular candidates or region of the country that adopted these techniques earlier? And to the extent that there was, what does that tell us about the nature of the candidates? I mean, it just occurs to me that, you know, we're talking about business practices. I imagine we're going to see the conflation, or I guess those business practices of marketing seep in more at the coast, but maybe that's just my own, I don't know, biases.
No, you're right. And in fact, that's one of the things that I talk about. I mean, there's sort of two aspects of this. First, you know, really early on, when we're talking about like the 1910s, 1920s, one of the things I talk about in the book is the way some of these techniques are first becoming apparent in presidential contests. And that's because presidential candidates are the first ones to try to develop a more direct connection to the public and therefore try to develop techniques, whether it's advertising or even early forms of polling, that would allow them to communicate more directly, but also to get a better sense of what the public thinks. And that's beginning, for example, with candidates like Woodrow Wilson, before him Teddy Roosevelt, and then extending through, let's say, Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. So presidents, I guess, may be the first place we begin to really see these efforts to craft new techniques and what I call political work, changing the nature of political work to become a more professionalized enterprise. Then in terms of the regional thing, California is really the incubator for the political consulting industry as we know it today. And that's because the first true political consulting firm, a firm called Campaigns Incorporated, which was a husband and wife team of Clem Whitaker and Leone Baxter, they began work in California in the 1930s. And between the 1930s and the 1950s, were incredibly influential in California politics, working on behalf of business associations who hired them in order to run campaigns, often for ballot initiatives in California, which was a big part of the political environment out there, to oppose initiatives that would have either regulated business or created an environment that business thought would be hostile to their interests. And they are the ones, Whitaker and Baxter, who really developed a business where they could sell these services to companies or trade associations. And what were those services? Things like pamphlets, advertising, polling, that would eventually lead to victory at the polls or victory in a ballot initiative.
On this program, some time back, we interviewed Catherine Olmsted, who wrote a book called Right Out of California about the the integration of big business roots of modern conservatism, coming out with a lot of anti-communist concerns around that. And so it's interesting that that's where that took place, because that seemed to be, at least in the country, the biggest expression of business in terms of really getting in a organized fashion into politics. But
I think that's right. I think actually one of the things that Whitaker and Baxter did was help business figure out or facilitate for business to be a more effective or more powerful political force in California. Just one important instance of that was the fight that Whitaker and Baxter waged against universal health care in California in the 1940s, where the governor of California wanted to propose a universal health care system for the residents of California. The California Medical Association of Doctors saw this as a threat to their interests. They hired Whitaker and Baxter, and what Whitaker and Baxter did was really create the first campaign that used the concept or the term socialized medicine as a kind of bugaboo to scare people into thinking that the quality of their health care would diminish if a universal health care plan was instituted. Their success in blocking universal health care in California is what drew the attention of the American Medical Association, which then hired Whitaker and Baxter to run a national campaign around the theme of socialized medicine at the national level when Truman proposed a national health insurance scheme in the late 1940s. So I think it's true that the kind of business methods that, in terms of marketing and advertising, which then migrated over into the political realm through people like Whitaker and Baxter, also had the consequence of providing business interests with a new way to participate and become very influential in the political process.
Okay, so we have this as the prehistory, and it makes sense that you would see it in the context of a national race or issues in a state the size of California, because you don't have, I guess it's really just trying to take advantage of new technologies at that time, or the lack of use of technology in running a political campaign, because the scale of these things obviously gets much, much bigger as, you know, when you go national as opposed to a local election. So we get to 1971, Buckley v. Valeo, and ostensibly, right, this is something that you would imagine in some way would, I don't know, I guess Buckley v. Valeo in this instance, and maybe it's the wrong to say that it ends up becoming a villainous role here, but it's an instigator for the consultant class in a way that one wouldn't necessarily expect.
That's right. I mean, the role of campaign finance is an interesting one, I think, and essentially it's something like this. Basically, we know that campaign finance did not do very well in terms of regulating the amount of money that could go into the system or go out of the system, right? I mean, that's something that began in the 1970s and continued through Citizens United and other more recent campaign finance Supreme Court decisions, that efforts to regulate how much people could spend or efforts to regulate how much people could give were deemed unconstitutional. And we're all familiar with that history. But one of the things that we may be less familiar with is that the campaign finance regime built in the 1970s that has survived these judicial challenges is the requirement that campaigns report very detailed expenditures or detailed reports of their expenditures. And this is because in the aftermath of Watergate, the campaign finance reform movement that came about after Watergate wanted to take out the sort of slush funds that were moving around the political system, as well as take out the money that was characteristic of local politics in cities like Baltimore, where I live, or Philadelphia or other large cities, where local party ward bosses would give out what was called walking around money on election day to make sure that the people in their districts or in their wards voted, right? They wanted to get rid of that. So the campaign finance system put in place these very clear rules that said, no matter, you can spend as much as you want, but you've got to say exactly what you spend that money on. And furthermore, when the Federal Election Commission, which was tasked with the implementation of these new rules, sat down to figure out how to do this, they said, look, we need to come up with some categories that we will consider legal expenditures that will not trigger an audit of a campaign. And when they came up with that list of specific expenditures, the list they came up with included things like polling, advertising, political consultants, fundraising expenditures, and other things. So what I argue, this is not the only reason why the political consulting industry began to really grow in the 1970s and 1980s, but I think a major factor was that essentially in the campaign finance regime that developed, consulting became the easiest way to legally spend money in our political system. So all the money that's coming in through donations and then increasingly through unregulated donations in the sense of the lack of any limits on how much money people could give, that money's got to go somewhere. You can't just pay somebody to vote. You've got to spend it in a way that will be considered legal by the Federal Election Commission. And the easiest way to do that is basically to buy ads. And that's one of the things that consultants really have benefited from, is that every ad that goes on television generates fees and commissions for that consulting firm. And so the combination of lots of money and a specific set of rules, I think, contributed a lot to the growth of the consulting industry in the 70s and 80s.
So, okay, now the auditing part seems somewhat obvious insofar as, or makes sense, I should say, because you're running a campaign, you want to be able to present, you know, sort of, you want to be able to be in compliance, and this is, you're hiring somebody who provides some type of indication that you're in compliance. The part about it being the easiest way to spend money versus the effectiveness of it is sort of the head scratcher, unless, and I guess this is what the book is really about, is unless you look at this thing rather from the perspective of what do you think a candidate would do and more of what do you think a consultant would do, right? I mean, it's like, you've got to look at this from the perspective of as if the consultant is the object, or I get that.
That's right.
Okay, so tease that out for us.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's really, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things I want to accomplish with this book is say, let's look at our politics from the perspective of the industry that has developed and the consultants who make their living in politics. Not to say that's the only thing that matters, but that's, I think, a neglected perspective, right? And when we look at it from the perspective of the consultants and we think about, well, what are their interests or incentives? And one of the basic ones is it's a business. That means they've got to figure out how they're going to keep the lights on. How are they going to keep in business from election to election? And that's actually harder than you think because elections are cyclical. Let's say it's every other year, say. It's maybe very uncertain. You don't really know how well your candidate's going to do. So there's a couple of strategies you can pursue. One is to figure out what part of the business is the most reliable source of revenue for you, and that clearly is things that are deliverable, like television or fundraising services that candidates cannot provide themselves. I mean, it used to be that consultants started out in kind of like general strategy. Let me give you advice on how to run your campaign. And many consultants were successful in that regard. But they were always running up against, well, why should I, believe you when somebody else could tell me a different story who knows my district better? But one of the things that consultants could provide that candidates couldn't provide themselves is access to the airwaves, as well as access to other sources of money through the fundraising apparatus of telephone calls and direct mail solicitations. And so from that perspective, consultants began to concentrate really in those areas because not only could candidates not provide that themselves, but because you could charge a sort of a commission or fee for the deliverable, every ad or every letter that you send out. And so if we think about it from the perspective of the consultants, they're going to push those things, right? They're going to say, look, you need to be on TV. You need to be raising money to pay for that TV, and I can help you do that. Now, you mentioned sort of the effectiveness thing, and I think that's a really important piece of this too, which is that television, it does have some effect. There's no question about it. But the research that's been coming out in the last few years shows that that effect is very limited, which is to say that only under certain certain conditions. If your opponent is spending as much as you are, it's probably not going to be as effective as if you have this extraordinary advantage over your opponent. And moreover, the effects are short-lived, like days as opposed to weeks. So all the money that gets spent early in a campaign may have relatively little influence on the eventual outcome. So why do they spend all the money? Well, I've suggested one is they've got to spend it on something. Another is that the consultants are pushing this on them because that's how they make their money. And
right.
I think
when
the
you're
third
a hammer,
thing, which,
when you're a hammer, everything is a nail, and you're selling that.
Exactly right. If you hire a media consultant, they're going to advise you on how to spend money on media. That's
right.
What they do. That's what they sell. And then furthermore is that, you know, we have to remember that politicians, even if they're incumbents, they're always running scared. They're always concerned that they might lose their job or they might lose the election. And so it creates this uncertainty that consultants, frankly, will exploit to a degree in order to sell their wares. Say, look, if you want to be sure about this, let's make sure we're on TV more than the other guy. And so that, I think, feeds into the process as well. And all those things together, I think, help us to understand why there's so much TV on the air, so much political TV, even though the evidence suggests that isn't always as effective. And we saw that in the current campaign with Jeb Bush, who spent millions and millions of dollars on TV, and it translated into very few votes when it came time to the caucuses and primaries.
To what extent, I mean, your book is incredibly timely, you know, just with like we watched Ben Carson essentially,
right.
You know, just sort of this self-licking ice cream cone where the candidacy seemed to be sort of incidental to everything else that was going on. Like it was really just, this is just a short-term cottage industry. And, people selling T-shirts on when a baseball team is going to head to the playoffs or something, has no impact on the actual outcome of the game, but somebody's going to make a ton of money off it. And Donald Trump, who largely seems to be his own consultant. But before we get there, how much of, like, I did some research the other day about how much money was being spent on television advertising and how much the media, how much money they get from campaigns. And it's an extraordinary amount. Like, certainly, it seems to me almost to be the biggest on an election year, by far the biggest amount of money, particularly local television, will get. Will come from from political campaigns, and the money is just huge. How much is that self-reinforcing? In other words, the consultants are the hammer, and everything's a nail, but the nail seems to be weighing in, saying, "Yeah, oh yeah, definitely, we're a nail." In terms of the larger media,
in terms of television
I can read a couple academics will tell me that the TV ad buys don't make any difference whatsoever.
Right.
But if I was to watch any cable news, they would never tell me that.
Right. Well, I mean, think about this as sort of like the ecosystem of politics, right? What are the different organisms that are in a kind of symbiotic relationship with one another? And consultants are in a symbiotic relationship with local TV, right? Because local TV has to sell time. The consultants are buying time on behalf of the candidates and take a cut of the proceeds, right? So both of them, they're not in cahoots, but they both benefit from the same system, which is a system of big money politics where donors are, pumping all this money into the system, and then it's finding its way to television. It's also the case that you can say to the donor, look, we need your money because we can run these ads. And look, here are the ads that your money bought for us, right? So that's like another part of the piece. But you're absolutely right. At the local level, if you talk to, sales execs for local television, their business absolutely depends on politics, right? In these election years, they make tons of money and they really would be unable to survive without it. Now, this also is an opportunity to come back just to one of those little wrinkles in the campaign finance system that, I think is really important for understanding money in politics. So one of the things that obviously we've seen in recent years is the rise of super PACs, and those super PACs create a vehicle for even more unregulated spending in political campaigns. But one of the things that super PACs don't get, which campaigns get, is the lowest available rate. election law stipulates that a candidate who wants to run an ad must be given the lowest available rate, which basically is an effort to try to reduce the cost of politics. It's a weak effort, but it's an effort nonetheless, which is to say that candidates won't get gouged, right? But a super PAC is not bound by those rules. They can get gouged from the in other words, the local TV station can charge them the highest possible rate available. And that further inflates the cost of our politics, because the more that super PACs are involved, the more costly it is for them to run the same amount of ads as a candidate, the more money than they need from their donors, and the system, you know, kind of goes on and on. So,
but because it's a percentage commission, let me just understand you. Because it's a percentage commission, if I'm a consultant, I don't want to work for the campaign. I want to work for a super PAC, because that means that I'm going to get charged more to run the ads in support of that candidate. And because I'm going to get charged more, I'm going to get paid more, because I've got a plus 10 or a plus 15 on any ad buy I make.
Well, that's if you're a consultant, you want to work for both, right? You want to have as many clients as you can.
Of course, but I'm saying if I've got a choice, I mean, because one of the interesting things about the Bush campaign was they farmed out a lot of their campaign services to a super PAC. That was the big story, you know, this time last year. It was like, they're doing something really innovative. But at the end of the day, that could have very well been a suggestion that was born out of someone realizing, like, I'm going to profit more if I have to buy that same ad as a super PAC versus the candidate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's for the, you know, one thing that is important to realize is that, you know, the way in which those contracts are set up by consultants is going to vary depending on the size of the entity, right? So a big presidential campaign, you know, a big super PAC, you're going to get a smaller commission than you did if you're working for like a congressman or a smaller race. So with that in mind, but it's also, I think you're right that you're going to want to attract a client who's got money, and the more money, the better. And I think that one of the things that I found striking about the Bush campaign is that all this money that went to the Right to Rise Super PAC, well, who ran the Right to Rise Super PAC? Well, a consultant named Mike Murphy. Which firms benefited from the spending by the Right to Rise Super PAC? Well, Mike Murphy's firm and a firm started by somebody who used to work for him. You know, that's where you have to wonder, you know, really, there's no question that a consultant wants their client to win, but they need their business to succeed. And they're going to make decisions both in light of what they think is in the best interest of their client, but also what they think is in the best interest of their business.
And I wonder if that dynamic isn't what has, I mean, it's been my theory, and part of it is because I think I come from talk radio and I'm more sensitive to the existence of all of these entities out there that aren't just simply sort of campaign consultants, but that dynamic of the self-dealing and the outlets that just the tremendous amount of money flowing through it, it creates fragmented and maybe agendas that are somewhat, that at the very least they're not identical, right? They may be sort of misaligned or just slightly misaligned because, you know, Mike Murphy, you know, at the end of the day, of course, he's not going to do anything to make his candidate lose, but his decision-making process is going to get a little bit clouded by the fact that, hey, this is the difference between a pool or not a pool, or, you know, my kid's braces or whatever it is, right?
Right. I mean, and that fragmentation, again, is another consequence of our campaign finance system, which, you know, going back to the 1970s, created sort of loopholes that allowed for first PACs and then super PACs to develop and to, as a result, fragment our political system where we have lots of different messages that really can't be completely coordinated with one another. But at the end of the day, you know, diminish the ability for coordinated action through party politics. And that probably wasn't a good thing for our democracy.
All right. Lastly, with an era of sort of digital democracy, is this going to go away? I mean, are we going to have like campaigns that are sort of crowdsourced themselves? Are we going to see any type of diminishment of this, particularly as you get more and more young people migrating away from these sort of mass media outlets in terms of where they get their entertainment and their information? And it's going to be harder and harder to sell this notion of, you should be putting, you should be going up on air. We should be buying ads right. everywhere. I mean, there's always going to be the Ben Carsons, right, who are sending emails to people like me looking for me to donate money to Ben Carson. I'm not going to. That was a clear indication that he got taken by somebody anyways who was selling him email right. lists and just wanted volume. But what happens
right.
here?
So look, the industry is going to go through some changes. It already has and has been going through changes beginning with the you know, really with the 2008 election or, and the 2012 election where digital techniques, data analytics, email solicitations, internet advertising really began to take off. So my view is the industry is not going away, but the industry is going to be adapting to these new techniques. And as I say in the book, I think that the digital business is going to be pretty much the same as the analog business that preceded it, which is that you're going to have these firms that are specializing in the products and services that are deemed to be the cutting edge methods of reaching voters and trying to get them to show up at the polls. Now, having said that, it's a little bit harder to make money from Facebook ads than it is from TV ads. Mm. There's just not the same margin. But I think that's going to press, you know, these firms to either incorporate data and digital techniques into their menu of services that might include old media as well as push politics into new areas and to use the tools of big data and the tools of digital media to target even more effectively than they have in the past. And so I hate to say it, but probably your Netflix feed is going to have political ads in the future, right? I mean, there's going to be ways in which the industry can use all of the information they have about us to continue to bombard us with ads, just like they're doing now with emails. And just like, as you mentioned, with the Carson email, a lot of times we're going to ignore it, just as a lot of times we're going to ignore these television ads. But that's the treadmill, right? That's the constant search that the industry has to find a new way to get our attention, a new way to therefore show to their clients that they're effective and useful and necessary in this political process.
I mean, it's a bit of a scam, isn't it?
Well, I like to say, you know, part of it is there's an artfulness to political consulting, but there's also a con artfulness to political consulting.
That's a good place to end it, Ed, aside from saying that they really should be investing heavily into podcasts. That's what I would... Adam Scheingate.
That's the next step.
From your mouth. Adam Scheingate, the book is Building a Business of Politics, The Rise of Political Consulting, and the Transformation of American Democracy. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.